Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
Everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We're going to be releasing this in September on Grey Malkin Lane, where we're going to be talking a lot about Marvel magic, Marvel cosmos building, and the concepts of Lovecraft and its impact on some of the industry and world building that exists. I am thrilled to be joined by my friend Al Ewing returning to the show. Al, always such an enormous honor to have you here. Al has been doing some crazy universe building at Marvel for a long time, playing with a lot of the blocks that have been left behind and building new things out of them. Al, how are you? Welcome back to Grey Malkin Lane.
I'm doing okay. As we record this, I've just come back from a trip to London where we kind of did a sort of post-Pride dance party thing. So that was a lot of fun.
Post-con or post-travel, I'm always very tired. But whenever I celebrate Pride events, I often wind up a little joy-saturated, which is a good feeling, right? Like, my joy receptors are a little overloaded and it leaves me weary because it's hard to step back into the regular world.
It's weird. I did like a lot of dancing, but it's the most relaxed I've been in a long time.
What's your signature dance move, Al Ewing?
I've been wanting to do more moves, more like big moves. So I do a lot of kind of spinning around. I do that thing where you sort of spin around, do a 360 on the beat.
Yeah. I'm picturing ABBA's Dancing Queen comes on and there you go.
There was some ABBA, right? I'm trying to remember what exactly. I'm not sure it was Dancing Queen. It might have been Layla, the Love and Me. But mostly we're doing sort of more kind of modern pop stuff. A lot of Chapel Roan these days gets played.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I love it. It's a powerful thing, especially in both our countries. 2025 is a rough place. There's a lot of conservative.
Yeah, it's not great.
Even kind of fascism bordering on in a lot of places. It's important to celebrate where we can, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think we might be like over that border. So we definitely have to take joy where we can and sort of have good times where there are good times there to be had.
So we're going to open today's interview in kind of an odd place. I grew up Mormon, gay and Mormon in a very conservative place. And Mormons, in the philosophy that I grew up in, Mormons have a very particular idea about the origins of the universe, much like a lot of cultures or traditions or religions do. In Mormonism, there's this question you want to ask, like, why are we here? What happens to us, right? And when we're looking for kind of purpose, we want to have like an understanding of origin. So there's this very complex thing in Mormonism called the plan of salvation, where you can go back a couple billion years and start talking about the origin of God and how God began as a human who eventually evolved into what he is and had billions of like spiritual children and built them a planet. Then there's, and I'm skipping over a whole bunch of stuff, but then there's this big war in heaven. And this ends up being Jesus. One person wants to like send men to earth to like test them and save them through grace. And Satan or Lucifer wants to send spirits to earth, but not give them the option of free will. Instead, allow them to just be automatically saved by allowing them to follow all the rules because agency would not exist. There's a giant war and only the ones that follow Jesus end up on earth. And those ones who end up at the highest levels of like obedience and worthiness end up becoming gods in their own time. I'm summing up a lot of things crazily, but it's really interesting to me as we're prefacing today's interview, when I start channeling man's need to understand their origins and like divine purpose. And when we go into the Marvel universe, the origins are oddly very similar, which is a very kind of crazy thing to consider.
With the cosmologies of Marvel, it's built from a whole bunch of people's different religious damage from, you know, the 60s, 70s to beyond. I mean, probably starting in the 70s, but it's a whole bunch of people with a whole bunch of like their own origin stories kind of writing that into this cohesive-ish universe. But yeah, that sounds absolutely wild. The whole
there's so many, a lot of stuff that we've seen in comics, everything, you know, prophecy to predestination to faith in the higher power. So much of that works into our superhero fiction, not just in Mormonism, but in like any religion. I think that that automatically kind of exists. Now, Marvel's cosmology is built, like you said, on a lot of different things. There's a ton of foundations put into it, but there always seems to be kind of the quest for man to reach that higher plane. We open Fantastic Four number one with the characters being hit by cosmic rays while launching themselves into space. Peter learning lessons about responsibility, mutants being the next evolution of man. It's all about kind of progression and worth and how we kind of commune with things. Doctor Strange, however, is the first character that really delves into that in Marvel. He kind of ascends to that like higher plane and interfaces with Eternity, who is like the embodiment of the cosmos. And Eternity is like a playable character in the Marvel Universe. We start adding characters like the Stranger and the Watcher and the Elders of the Universe. And over the decades, these mythos have been built on again and again. Galactus, of course, is a huge piece. Infinity, the concept of death and the way she influences Thanos. So there's this giant cosmology of playable characters. And I think one of the major origins of all of this is Lovecraft himself, who built these huge worlds of extra-dimensional monsters and projected consciousnesses, all kinds of things. Do you have a particular relationship with the Lovecraftian mythos? I know, by the way, that they are very deeply rooted in racism and eugenics, and there's a lot of complicated stuff there. It's crazy.
I mean, personally, I think my relationship with Lovecraft is probably, it's pretty basic. It's pretty much like the average, such a relationship on the culture that you end up, I can't say I've really read, I've probably read like one Lovecraft story in my whole life, and I couldn't tell you which one either. But the influence of Lovecraft on culture, it's like, so when I was growing up, there was a role-playing game called Cthulhu, which was just like, you know, one of the big role-play. It was Dungeons and Dragons, and then if you didn't like that, there were a couple of others, and one of them was Call of Cthulhu, and that was like, oh yeah, that's the horror one. That's the one where you've got like sanity rolls, and you've got to stop going mad, and it's all the Lovecraft stuff, and it's like, you just knew who Cthulhu was, you know. Lovecraft achieved, kind of like Bram Stoker and Mary Shelley, one of these things where like his creations kind of enter the public consciousness almost through osmosis, like they're just floating around in the cultural atmosphere. And you know, if you, the adjective Lovecraftian, you know what that means, you know what kind of horror that is, you know roughly, if somebody says, oh yeah, I'm writing something Lovecraftian, you know what they mean, you know what they're trying to do. So I guess my relationship with Lovecraft is just, I'm sort of swimming in the waters of the post-Lovecraft world, the kind of, I guess all of my sort of ideas and opinions about like the Cthulhu mythos and Craftian, what it means, they're only sort of, oh, it's like second hand. I'm kind of, you know, I have opinions, but they're all based on this sort of, the way what came out of Lovecraft has sort of bounced off all of these surfaces, all these angles, and kind of come back to me.
Its impact on popular culture is more relevant than specific people latching on, because these ideas were in place in so many sci-fi stories before we, you know, came around. Now, when we look at this in relation to the Marvel cosmos, there are a lot of additive things. We begin with Eternity and Galactus and these kind of high concept ideas. And later writers, from Stan Lee to Mark Gruenwald to Roger Stern to more modern writers like Jerry Duggan and Dan Slott and yourself, really kind of taking the playing pieces and making them big. I have talked about this on the show, but there's some really fun stuff in Quasar under Gruenwald, where we see a place called the Dimension of Manifestations, where all these eternal concepts are like building bodies for themselves to be able to interact. And it's almost as though the gods are sitting down together, but they all represent different concepts. There are parallels like Death and Oblivion, which is currently being played out in huge ways along with Eternity in Mirewa Ayodele's Storm series. We see Master Order and Lord Chaos, the Living Tribunal, the powers that be, the natural order of things, life and love and hate, the in-betweener, and the Phoenix Force is all part of this as well. But we also have this idea of the Celestials and the first cosmos and the way that that has built into the seventh and eighth cosmoses and the way that we exist. Now, you are one of the few writers, and we did discussed this in your original interview, who've really taken this and tried to expand it in huge ways, first in Ultimates and later in your Defenders Beyond work, but also in your work on Krakoa, where we look at things like the Dominions. Now, I'm tossing this all over the place, but do you want to talk about how you first became familiar with the rules of the Marvel Cosmos and how you chose to create these as your building blocks for the stories you're telling?
I guess the first kind of, because Eternity is sort of the first major one, as you say, when the Epic Collections came out, which was really like the first major opportunity to kind of go back and look at this stuff on, you know, a reasonable budget, was those big black and white Epic Collections. And, you know, I guess I'd have been in my 20s when those came out. Those were like the 2000s, the early to mid 2000s, I feel like, when those dropped. The big phone books, the big kind of, not the first giant phone book, I guess the originals would probably be Cerebus, but like definitely the first, we're going to collect all of the old stuff in a way people can afford. It's, and you know, to begin with, black and white, but you get them in color now. And then, you know, I had like, when it got onto like the Engelhardt Strange stuff, and you had stuff like the entire universe blowing up and then, you know, Doctor Strange having to kind of recreate it. I sort of homaged that moment a little bit in Defenders, because that whole run with Engelhardt ends with like Doctor Strange having to like come down from the trip. That's how we ended the first Defenders mini. There was a major move to archive stuff, or rather present archives of stuff to people in the 2000s that really helped them. Again, we mentioned Quasar earlier and all of the great work Mark Grunwald did. That's really difficult to find still. That's still difficult to find. It's hard. It's not really on Marvel Unlimited in any.
Good. I have the whole run. It's solid. I really enjoy it.
It's hard to get hold of. It's not like these early Doctor Strange stories where you can pick them up, you can read them. So I feel like there's gonna come a point where Quasar is sort of archived properly, or like reprinted properly. And what's gonna happen is that a whole bunch of people are gonna, on the creative side, are gonna get the chance to read through all this stuff. And after that, there's gonna be a major kind of reappraisals and attempt to fit all of that stuff back in. Because I think certainly the case of me, I was sort of trying to fit in as much as I could in terms of, I was trying to fit in as much as I could in terms of everything that had come before, make it fit, while at the same time trying to do what I wanted to do thematically. And sort of, so a few things from the 90s didn't make it. I think I pushed Abraxas off to the side. I feel like...
We won't talk about Abraxas today, everybody, but go look him up.
Yeah, I feel like I kind of pushed him off the side. I sort of didn't really want to deal with him. But like, I know that the generation coming after me creatively have like fond memories of Abraxas. So like, I feel like it's a matter of time if it hasn't happened already before Abraxas comes back. But that's the kind of thing, you know, I'm taking a lot from like my understanding of those 70s of things. A lot of it's stuff like, you have stuff like Engelhardt, who's like dabbling magic. You got Lee and Ditko, which I know Lee definitely wanted to kind of get sort of, I guess, get cosmic, for want of a better word, get kind of like, but in a very hip way. But like Ditko, you know, visually just these incredible sort of idea beings. And then you have people follow up on that with like, you have Stalin just building this enormous. And then I guess people like Grunwald and also Jim Shooter, I guess. Secret Wars 2 was a major influence on me as a kid.
Yeah, so let's talk about a couple of these high concepts. And again, it's additive playing blocks, and we're not going to delve deep into the origins, but to cover this almost in a biblical way, and I'm not Christian in any way, but I do think there's a lot of Christian mythology here. In the beginning was the first cosmos. It existed unchanging and it was lonely. So it created the aspirants, beings that were sent forth to create life that would not change, but it also created the celestials, beings who wanted to evolve and grow. In time, this led to a war between the two creations, which is very God creating Cain and Abel almost, you know, they eventually are going to war, because in the Garden of Eden, there was no progression until they stepped outside and learned. But this ended up fracturing that first cosmos or first firmament and creating the second cosmos, which is the first version of the multiverse. Now, the first firmament ends up becoming its own sentient being. Think of it like a captive eternity. And this is a character Al will bring up later in some of his adventures as kind of an entity that exists to destroy our world. So this cosmos in the second universe created the Omegas to monitor the multiverse from outside of the multiverse. And these beings end up becoming called the Beyonders because they're viewing the world from beyond. There's a lot of confusing origins for the Beyonders, and we'll talk more about them. But this realm is kind of what what exists, where like the cosmic cubes can tap into them and eventually hatch into their own beings. This is also kind of the space, if you read like Sinister Becoming a Dominion, he goes out to the beyond and can view the whole multiverse from outside. So it's another playable realm. So now the cosmos can age and there is change. Eventually the second cosmos retires, becomes the third cosmos, which is the place that starts creating the concepts of heroes. Al has some work with like a Lifebringer one, that stuff. That eventually becomes the fourth cosmos, where more of the consistent patterns of heroes and villains come into existence. And we see this very beautifully portrayed, Al, in your work in Ultimates number 100, Ultimates 2 number 6, and the Defenders Beyond series really explains all this in a clear way. Now, the fourth cosmos eventually goes on, again, as an eternity being, a playable character, to be its own entity that now exists. And you readapted that into the character, the Queen of Nevers, combining a Dan Slott character with this idea of cosmos. And the Queen of Nevers, I read, is trans. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Her sister is something called the Griever at the End of All Things, who you'll notice a balance in all of this, right? We have progression balanced by death very consistently. The idea of stagnation versus progression is something that all ecosystems rely on. In the fifth cosmos, we see magic and sorcery come into existence. Morodun is among them, who is a very Cthulhu-like character who goes on to become like an extra-dimensional sorcerer called Omnimax. In the sixth cosmos, science is introduced. And then in the seventh cosmos, this is where eternity and infinity become kind of the twin embodiments of the cosmos itself. They go on to form our universe, which has since in the Jonathan Hickman Secret Wars series become the eighth cosmos. But we're not going to delve deep into that today. So our current universe then has its own very complex origins, which we'll talk a little bit about high concept in a moment. Al, what's it like to hear kind of the recounting of your work establishing these previous cosmoses?
Sort of to hear a recounting like that, it's almost like hearing it backwards, because like all of this stuff was sort of built on previous stuff and like new iterations of like stories I told that I sort of, oh wait, I could do a bit more with that. But originally it came from a need to sort of work out, I mean, the secret kind of origin of all of this stuff is that I did a Contest of Champions tie-in book around, I want to say like 2015, but around then. But I did like, it came out right after Secret Wars, the Jonathan Hickman version. You know, it was a book based on a Muppets, as fun as I could, as good as I could, and I threw in a bunch of, I had to explain why all of this stuff was happening. In the mobile games, you have this thing called ISO-8, which is just game currency. It's just like, you know, you blow
it's a,
your...
It's a power-up for your crystal. I played that game at Marvel Avengers Alliance for years. I played that hours every day.
That was in, we all did. We all had a crack at it. It was like, so it was in that. It was in Constant Champions. I don't know if it was in any of the others, but like it was huge in those two. Since I was doing a Constant Champions time book, I thought it'd be fun to have some ISO-8 in there. And then I kind of brought it into the other books I was doing as well, which was Ultimates. I thought, well, let's have this stuff actually be important since it's so important in the games. We might as well have it in the actual thing. It can be like one of these fun little, and it's just, I ended up just making it sort of, I think I had like cosmic cubes are kind of made out of it, but it's like, it hasn't really come up since. But since it had the, I mean, it, you know, it, there's not much you can do with it that doesn't remind people of mobile games. So, you know, there's a lot better magic metals and magic materials out there. But it has the number 8 in it. So to explain it, I had the idea that like this stuff was actually, there'd been like an ISO 7 before that, but it's like a sort of universal kind of power primordial stuff, you know, since the universe began again. And, you know, Power Primordial is a thing that exists. It was already there. I feel like Dan Slott had done a bunch with it. It was one of those great, I think it's what the Elders of the Universe run on. If the Power Primordial that comes to the beginning of the universe is called ISO 8 now, that sort of implies that we're in the 8th one. Therefore, the one that just finished was the 7th. The 7th Cosmos. That's fun. We can do stuff with that. That means Galactus was from the 6th. And suddenly we're off to the races. Suddenly we're like, okay. And then, you know, and I was doing all this in Ultimates, and I was sort of thinking about it. One thing I do a lot of, this really started going crazy in Defenders, but like I'll sort of spot things in places and go like, oh, well, I'll use that little phrase, that little turn of phrase, I'll sort of, that was as the first firmament. And there was like, there was a bunch of stuff in Matt Fraction Defenders forum that I liked with sort of death celestials. And sort of Omega Council. Oh, well, we've got these Death Celestials. We've got the first firmament. This is all fun. And if, you know, if I sort of give these things, these concepts, names that have already been kind of already floating around in the background, that's fun. It makes the whole universe seem a lot more kind of coherent and interesting. So, you know, suddenly the first firmament was, okay, that's going to be the big bad. That's going to be the thing that like change eternity up. And this all built to a thing where like I had this final issue of the Ultimates. I was kind of, this, I feel like I was probably planning this for at least a little while, but I thought, oh, let's have all of the old multiverses come back. And they're all like eternity type beings, and they can come and they can form a super team. And as it turned out, because, you know, that issue kind of came to a premature end, that series, I had to do it all in like a double spread. So I had to come up with all sorts of like narration and sort of, and, you know, at the time, the Fantastic Four were sort of not in the picture because of, I don't know, corporate shenanigans of some form or another. You know, number four, the Fantastic Four aren't there. But I was using all this stuff like True Believer, Journey into Mystery, Pilgrim. The fourth Cosmos was called the Pilgrim, and that's because Stan Lee used to say Pilgrim all the time. But I mean, so much of this is just like using the language of Marvel Comics, but also language of Marvel Comics publishing, the kind of, all of these sort of these phrases that have kind of popped in, you know, partly as like Stan the Carnival Barker, partly as sort of like the Junction to Everywhere was like a kind of just like thrown out on the page, but it has such, that's a phrase with such power that you kind of, yeah, you sort of bring it back. You know, Journey, such an evocative title that, you know, I'm always bringing that one back. But like, I guess what I try to do with that sort of thing is try to tie the publishing history of Marvel into the cosmology of Marvel. Recently I did like a giant size thing. It's a giant size Spider-Man thing. And the brief there was like, we'd like to introduce the why are we called the 616? That's an odd one. But like, we'd like to do something with the retailers. So can we have a story that sort of explains that? There's a sort of multiversal big threat. I put Spider-Man in there, so it ended up going into the big Spider-Man special. Spider-Man, one of the very first Marvel heroes, the first solo Marvel hero in many ways. You know, do we count the Hulk as a hero? So Spider-Man, one of the golden oldies, and like Wynn, like the newest hero guy at Marvel. You know, team up. It's like the old and the new. And then they kind of investigate something that's happening in the lab where the torch first flamed on, the golden bodies. And the reason for that is because that is the beginning of the Marvel Universe. That is the first act of creation, is like Human Torch episode one, which, you know, contradicts everything we're saying here about like the first firmament. And, you know, there was a, because yeah, all of those things happened before, but they happened retroactively. The first actual event in Marvel is Professor Horton like talking on the phone about this robot he's made. It's
but again, really... the creation of life in its own way, right? When we start talking about all these different high concepts like death and eternity and oblivion, the idea that all of these entities existed in previous universes as their own independent ones, and the ones that we're seeing in our universe are the most modern ones, but they're still billions of years old, right? Earth becomes kind of the focal point for all of the magic in our cosmos, and there's so much given to Earth. So in 1976 is when Jack Kirby creates the Celestials, and we see them coming to Earth to experiment, creating the Deviants and the humans and the Eternals, which are mythos we've all seen explored. We could take a character like Death, who deserves her own episode, and she has her own mythology. There's things associated with her specifically, just like the Phoenix Force is associated with the White Hot Room and specific characters. We often see these entities choosing avatars or powering up humans. We see the Celestials coming to Earth again and again, but also the things that they've created that are out of control, both in this universe and in previous universes, who come back to threaten our universe. So these concepts are used quite often, and they interface a lot with characters, again, like Mr. Sinister as the Dominion or Franklin Richards. There's all these different ideas of that high concept kind of creation energy. Steve Orlando, even in the recent Scarlet Witch books, has brought both the Griever at the End of All Things and the Queen of Nevers in as big characters in his current world building for the Scarlet Witch, who taps into the ideas of chaos. Now, when it comes to mutants are seen as kind of the next evolution, who, that's what the Earth was created to have evolved into all along. But we also see, even in Stan and Jack books back at the beginning, humans are entitled to activate what they call the Destiny Force if they evolve themselves high enough. And you see that played out in the Kree-Skrull War and in Avengers Forever. I'm kind of throwing a lot at the wall here, but there's a lot of really interesting concepts that are all worthy of longer exploration that are all on a similar theme. One of the most complex ones, and this is one I want to delve into you with a little bit, Al. Can you tell everyone what a demiurge is?
Oh, the demiurge. Yeah, that's great. I mean, I can, but I can't. No,
which is,
sorry.
Which is also how we describe the Phoenix Force. I can, but I can't.
I was thrown for a loop by the mention of the Destiny Force, because that's actually one of the ones. That's one of the big, old, great kind of forces, like the primordial. It's one of the ones I've never actually got my sticky fingers on, so I've never
Yeah, the Destiny Force is, Rick Jones ends the Kree-Skrull War by just, like, freezing time, basically. Oh, this is the human evolution potential. But Kurt Busiek later picks up that theory in Avengers Forever hugely. Like, it's a huge plot point in that 12-issue macro series, which is well worth it.
I mean, I've read that, but a long time ago. I was always planning to have sort of Songbird go from New Avengers into that. She's phoning somebody called, like, Ought the Living Galaxy, and it's like, I just never had an opportunity to, like, bring that in, and, you know, in my little book. So I guess Songbird is still destined to join the regular Avengers someday, and then somebody's gonna bring back this character that Kurt kind of mentioned, and then the Demiurge.
This is weirdly like the Phoenix in its way. It's an ultimate evolution that was there from the beginning, but also it's a modern character.
I mean, I really got into the Demiurge when I with Thor, but originally the Demiurge is from a Thor annual 10, I want to say, which deals with a whole bunch of the Elder Gods. And it's basically, Thor has to fight the Demogorgon. The Demogorgon gets this wild origin which is basically, the Elder Gods having this war, and it's basically it's C'thon and Set. There aren't very many Elder Gods when that original annual story is told. There are only just a few. It was in my interest to have there be a lot of them, but got to imagine that a lot of them get killed in this war, just eaten by the Demogorgon.
Yeah. So to sum up really quickly for listeners, when the current version of Eternity manifests. Mm. It creates its own kind of primordial concepts. There's a lot of gods that exist at the time. There's a huge war, very similar to that first cosmos between the Aspirants and the Celestials. Some of these gods become very playable characters. They're entities that Doctor Strange draws upon, or they're characters like Chthon who get locked in the mountain and, possess people, write things like the Darkhold. Some of the Elder Gods go on to create other creatures who are also entities that get used in these
same things. These aren't things that come from Eternity. These aren't things that kind of come out of the cosmos, out of space, because alien planets have their own gods. These are all things that come out of the Earth as it's like primordial soup bubbling. And the reason they come out of the Earth is because this giant face appears in the sky, not explaining himself or speaking or saying anything, and just pulls up all of these Elder Gods and then just hangs out on watches for a bit. And eventually one of the Elder Gods, Gaia, decides that there's been enough fighting in a very, in this very mythological incesty way, but marvelized, so we don't get into all of the incest that used to be in myths. But she basically has the Demiurge kind of impregnate her with the first of the major gods, the super gods. If the Elder Gods are like Titans, this is like the first main god. It is patterned after Zeus and the Titanomachy and these very kind of Greek concepts.
And Al's using this hugely in his recent run on Immortal Thor, by the way, right? With the concept of Utgard Loki and Tyrannos.
Yeah, the Utgard gods, and Utgard it's in the Eddas. It's just a place in Jotunheim, but the Sorcerous Giants, it was retold by Roy Thomas, which, makes it fair game as far as I'm concerned. I kind of expanded Utgard into a sort of another realm that's sort of not a realm, because 10 realms sounds great, 11 realms, okay.
In the Asgard mythology, yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's it should be 9 realms. And, I'm doing my bit to have 9 realms again for a while. It is now 10 realms. And once you get to 11 realms, it's that doesn't roll off the tongue so well. Utgard is not a realm. It's bigger than that. It's weirder than that. It's another place. And it's where Elder Gods live. But to get back to the Demiurge, I cannot stress enough how this is just a big face. And nobody really knows what it's about. Nobody knows why it did it. Nobody knows who it was working for. I'm going to stress here, as both a Marvel, you know, Marvel writer of long standing, but also as a 47-year-old man who's been around the block a few times creatively, I don't think we should ever know what the deal is with the Demiurge. Because there's going to be some hit young gunslinger. You know, part of the new generation are getting into doing cosmic stuff right now. I know pretty much the whole Immortal Thor, Mortal Thor, whatever Act 3 of that is, cycle. That's probably going to be my last big cosmic Marvel thing, just because, you know, I'm looking around me and there are so many just hungry young people. Steve Hollander's going to be very happy that I called him a hungry young man. The new kids on the block.
Much like it's very difficult to describe what the Phoenix Force is. Is it the ultimate evolution of Jean? Yeah. Is it the projected consciousness of all mutants? Is it Hope Summers? Is it a primordial concept? There's been recent stories that talk about how, and I'll sum this up very quickly, Wanda Maximoff draws upon the powers of Chthon and brings in some scattered essences of the devil and the magic of a village of witches and creates life in her womb, giving birth to Wiccan and Speed. Yeah. Wiccan then goes on to become projected up to become the Demiurge, but Al has recently kind of reclaimed that and said the Demiurge is not just one thing. It's a lot of things all at once, which I think is appropriate.
Wiccan's very important to a lot of people. He's got a lot of fans. I don't think he should be going back into primordial time, creating Gaia and then impregnating her. I think that's very off-brand for the guy. So he's going to be a Demiurge.
First of all.
Yeah. I mean, that, okay, you know, you can't have, like, modern people go back and be these slightly weird myths that are, like, patterned after the myths of old, which were slightly weird. I don't think it does work in any good for him to, like, one day become the big face in the sky from Thor Annual 10. You know, Wiccan's going to, like, become a Demiurge in the future and, like, whatever that looks like, not somebody else, but, like, because why would you want him to be? What, you know, there's a lot of Wicca fans who are like, oh man, it's terrible that he's not the Demiurge. No, it's good. It's good that he's not the Demiurge anymore, because I cannot stress enough, the Demiurge is weird. It's weird as hell. I'll tell you what the Demiurge is to me. I'll tell you my Philip K. Dick. I don't think he was on acid at the time, but he, you know, there was a point where Philip K. Dick was sort of writing, going out into a shack in the desert to write, you know, little office. And on the way out there, one day, he looked up into a gigantic, hideous metal face, like the entire sky was metal and the sky had a face. And he's quoted, there's like a paragraph long quote from Phil Kadek where he basically like looks up and goes, oh, it was terrible, it was metal, it was evil, it was pure evil, and worst of all, it was God. And then he went and he wrote The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, which is like, oh, who could that horrible metal face belong to?
Philip K. Dick, everybody, another infamous sci-fi writer. Take time to look. Brilliant. Died in 1982. Why,
you know, this face in the sky that Philip K. Dick saw, you know, it was like he could tell stories based on that vision, but like I don't believe he ever tried to explain it. And I feel like the person who wrote this, I'm not 100% sure if they did much else for Marvel. If they just like,
are you talking about Thor Annual 10 specifically?
Yeah, Thor Annual 10 specifically. I've got to remember who
Thor Annual 10 was written by Grunwald and Alan Zelenitz, who both did a lot of this stuff at Marvel.
Okay, so they did loads.
But it is a very high concept. Let's look at these realms of gods as they exist.
Yeah.
How does the Asgardian line play up against the Egyptian line?
Yeah.
And it introduces, again, the Demigorge and the Demiurge and this idea of the Elder's gods and this kind of high epic adventure, which is really fun. The Demigorge first shows up in Thor 300, but that's also Mark Grunwald story.
I mean, I don't think that the Demiurge should ever be explained. I think it would really just lessen the punch of the concept if like we found out that it was, you know, the Watchers built one or whatever. And I mean, I know I've been guilty of that a lot. I've been guilty of like connecting a lot of like, you know, little bits of the Meccano together and kind of creating structure where once it was a big beautiful like soup of poetry. So, you know, I am guilty, but this one thing, I think we leave it alone. We leave it alone.
There is a consistency, and this is where I'll bring up our last topic here for today at least, although we can talk for hours, Al. There is a consistency to the idea of ecosystems, right? Life deserves to exist, but life unchecked means that it squelches out other life. So death must be part of that concept, as must change, because life needs to be become something different as time goes by. An ice age happens on Earth and species are wiped out, but that paves the way for new evolution. So one of the primordial concepts through all of this is the character of Galactus, who is the survivor of the previous universe, who then comes to our universe and is attaching himself to something called the power cosmic. Galactus does have a will. There is an entity within. There's a consciousness. There's a being that he used to be, and now this kind of elevated being he's become. But he exists in a cosmic balance. He must wipe out planets and be kind of consumed by endless hunger. So we take a character like Galactus, we give him heralds, we give him mythology, and this is a very frequent, more than the Celestials, more than Eternity, this is a character that comes back again and again and again. So when you launched your Ultimates book, you had the Ultimates kind of trying to save the universe in a way, because Galactus is consuming planets. Let's reset this being and create the life bringer instead of the death bringer. And of course, Galactus ends up getting reset. We love the big visual of like Franklin Richards from the other universe has a dead Galactus as his ship, right? Mm. We keep going higher concept and lower concept. What is it about the character of Galactus that you think people latch on to so much? We're about to see this character. It'll come out before we release this, but the Fantastic Four movie is going to put this concept up on the big screen again.
One of the reasons I did that to Galactus was because he'd been hit pretty hard, I thought, by the noughties in that, like, the big overcorrection against sincerity, become almost a joke character. He'd kind of turn up and he'd be this big goofy guy who nobody would take seriously. I kind of thought, well, let's not have stories where Galactus comes to eat the planet for a while. Let's have stories where Galactus like creates new planets and suddenly everybody's got to deal with that. And nobody really picked up on that. Nobody really thought there were any interesting stories there, which... except me.
There's a story that lives in my brain from Mark Waid's run on FF where they devolve Galactus back into his human form and he's like hanging out on Earth with the Human Torch for a while. There's a lot of fun ways to treat this character.
There's a lot of stuff you can do with Galactus. I feel like his very first appearance, that it just sets the tone so much in terms of like, this is something so immense. It can barely be conversed with. You can't beat him. The only way to even see him off, to make him reconsider, the only way to make him see you as like anything other than like an ant, a buzzing ant or a gnat, is for the Human Torch to go on this kind of journey into psychedelia. Like he's kind of to become like this sort of pure Kirby essences, which, you know, Stan tries to explain, but the best job he does is when the Human Torch comes back and Stan just writes him like babbling and like trying to desperately communicate what he's seen and he can't. You know, issue 50 is not far into the book, and it's really, in some ways, that pairing has real trouble going that big again. And in fact, Marvel as a whole has trouble going that big again and getting to that level. And I feel like Stan Jack kind of come close with the origin of Galactus has to happen in Thor, because, you know, only Thor is big enough to handle it. And then they kind of they tinker with it. They rewrite a little bit, because it's like, oh, well, he kind of flew into a sun, you know, that's not quite big enough. So the secret to, oh, actually an entire universe died, and then like the life force of the universe like bugged him, and yeah, finally we've got close to like something that could be the origin of Galactus. So like Galactus is just huge, and is probably the first of those big huge things. I don't know where he falls in relation to Eternity, but, you know, one of these is Kirby, one of these is Ditko. Eternity is a puzzle that must be solved. It's not a thing that has to be fought. It's not a thing that, like, is too big to fight. It's a thing that is the end of a quest for understanding.
Well, and if you look at Eternity as the manifested consciousness of the seventh cosmos, yeah. Galactus is the being left over from the sixth cosmos that is there to kind of put a counter on this ever-expanding multiverse, because a Galactus exists in each multiverse, right? And it's there to consume the planets in each one. So yeah, it's very high concept. A lot of my listeners and a lot of readers really struggle with high concept stuff, like gods and realms and multiverses and time travel. But we also, this is the lifeblood of so many of our superhero stories. When we have writers like yourself who can do this high concept stuff well and make it make sense, it's so beautifully done. And sometimes I read a story where I'm like, oh, that was too much. Why did we have to have a council of cross time Kangs? Now my head hurts.
It is interesting that, like, sort of, I wasn't even thinking of Eternity in terms of like everything we've loaded on him since. I was going like right back to that kind of first, and it's like I say, it's like the publishing history is the true cosmology. It's like the kind of all this stuff we've woven around these characters. It's almost, I mean, this is true for me. I don't know if it's true for all of the other creatives, and there are a lot of them. But like, increasingly, as I do this stuff, I'm trying to express things about the publishing history, the history in our world of this. I'm sort of attempting to kind of take that, this higher knowledge that we have of it, of the kind of the history of the comics. Yeah. And sort of express it inside this fictional space.
And we go to these places like the House of Ideas and the One Above All.
Oh, yeah. Well,
let's even zoom way down into the Microverse for a moment, which is one realm within the but there's this kind of power primordial that manifests as Captain Universe as it goes through these different places. So this concept exists, this kind of projected consciousness of the universe. This interview is going to come out in September. It's going to be accompanied by episodes throughout the month where we discuss the book Mystic Arcana, which is kind of the Marvel magic rule book. We're also doing, I'm doing an interview with Matt Ruff, the author of Lovecraft stuff. And we're going to close the month out with the Trial of Agatha Harkness, because we're going to talk a lot about a high concept magic things within the realm as well. I love throwing ideas like this at different listeners. Alice, we're wrapping up. I'd love to hear any resonant thoughts you have, but I just want to reemphasize what an enormous fan of yours I am. I think it's
Thank
so
you.
Fun
Thanks
to
so much.
Talk high concept with you. This is delicious. I appreciate you coming on.
I mean, my immediate resonant thought, that the thing that's popping around my skull right now is, like, you mentioned the microverse, we can't use it. Well, we can, but we can't, because what we can't use is the Micronauts, because the Micronauts are not owned by Marvel. They're something else. That's I feel like the last Micronauts comic was like, it came out from Image or somewhere.
Yeah, but they're still playable characters. You just get different names, right? But the first volume of
stuff.
The first volume of Micronauts ends with the heroes like sacrificing themselves in order to allow the universe to reborn, which is very similar to the way that Onslaught ends, right? Like on the heroes have to feed themselves to Onslaught so that Franklin Richards can create the new Blue Ball universe. And very similar to the Secret Wars, we have to fuel all the stuff to birth the Eighth Cosmos, which is very similar to the Dominion, who has to consume all this life to give to elevation to something new. Those are all Galactus stories as well. I think it's fascinating how it ties all together.
It's just really interesting that like there are parts of Marvel that are now inaccessible, and how does that sort of, because we still have all of the leftovers. Like, we don't have ROM, but we do have the Space Knights. We don't have like the Micronauts, but I don't know if we have the Enigma Force like by name, but we have.
You just can't call Rom anymore. But he's still
exactly. He can't be like that boxy guy from like the toys, but the Space Knights are still around, Galador is still around. That's just really fascinating, just the whole kind of how this cosmology is so based on what the, because you know, when they imagine being like on this fictional plane of existence and attempting to kind of understand it all. And this is why, you know, a couple of times now I've had characters like meet the one above all, like the kind of highest representative of the creative force. And I think it's important that like when they meet the one above all, their answers they can fully comprehend, because like, you know, if the one above all like comes down to your level and gives you, you know, a pep talk, which happens a lot, but like that works because it's the writer talking directly to the character. If the characters go to meet the one above all, like in the House of Ideas, in the place where might like that first brush with Galactus, it's like it should be this mind-blowing, impossible to comprehend experience. It should be like fictional characters attempting to like kind of get a handle on our reality, and it can't be done.
And then I think listeners, you know, channeling every comic book nerd I've ever met, they're going to go like, oh my God, why do we have to do things like the one above all? But then they're going to immediately follow that question with what? So is there a one above the one above all? people want less of it, but also want more of it always, which is really interesting.
That's the mystery. That's the mystery that intrigues the one above all.
The multiverse is one thing, but what if you zoom out and there's multiple multiverses that make an omni verse, and then are there multiple verses?
that's what I like. And I mean, I thank Mark Waid for this, because Mark Waid just like wrote, you know, the one above all is Jack Kirby, and in the process did all these amazing lines, and one of them was like, the mystery intrigues me. That really spoke to me in terms of like, oh yeah, it's, you know, even this like highest possible being, this sort of god figure, is like, No, wanting to know, wanting to like seek out knowledge, wanting to kind of like, there's a reason why all of these stories are being told. So that's really cool.
Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned. In the latter half of this episode, we're going to have a script reading of some early Captain Britain adventures with an all queer cast based in London and Scotland. So a nice little palate cleanser after our high concept stuff today, until we get into Otherworld and the Captain Britain core, but we're not going to go there today. Al, where can people find you online? Is there anything you'd like to plug for September of 2025?
I have, and the other is promotional for comic stuff. So I'm at Al Ewing Writes Comics, and there's also an account called Al Ewing Promotes Comics, which makes it sound like I should be promoting more comics than just my own. There's a wonderful guy called Tyler who runs that for me. So like, it's very much just a kind of...
And as far as your Marvel work, you've got Thor coming out. Is there anything else
you're
prepping for?
There is Mortal Thor on the stands at the moment. All New Venom by September will have...
That's so fun.
It's probably September. Let me think. It's probably still All New... It's either still All New Venom or it's return to being called Venom because we're going legacy numbering because it's a big old... it's issue 250. We're going back to the legacy numbering, and the title is going back to Venom.
Talking high concept, we won't go there today, but we didn't even discuss the King in Black.
It's been announced as we speak, but definitely by September, that Null is back. I will let readers find out for themselves what form Null is back in. But yeah, that's probably the most interesting example of like a recent big god guy added to like the Marvel cosmology, the Marvel pantheon. That's probably the closest thing we've had in a while to that kind of great old Jim Starlin, let's invent a guy kind of energy. I've really come around to Null. Kind of.
Yeah, another high concept character. We'll talk about another time.
I really like him. He's just so evil. It's great. We need, because Thanos was always a little bit like philosophical. And I mean, I don't like Thanos to be too evil. So, like, too, you know, mustache-really evil. He's got to be evil, but he's got to be that kind of, like, philosophical evil where he's also, like, tempting and he's also, you know, he argues with you and all of this. But there needs to be somebody who's just full-on a nightmare. And that's Null, so Null's great. Yeah, you know, people can find out. He's back. Across the aisle, I'm doing all Absolute Green Lantern. It's getting to a stage where it's this really sort of dreamlike odyssey into some of these ideas and like recreations of some of these ideas. So that's a fun one. What I'm seeing is that people seem to be liking it more and more the more it goes on. So presumably by September, people will be really into it. And I think that's probably it, those three. Metamorpho sadly no longer with us.
Make sure to check out Al's work. Go back and look at Defenders Beyond and Ultimates as well. Al, what a joy to have you on today. Thank you so much for your valuable time. And thanks everyone for listening. Stay tuned. We'll be back with Captain Britain in just a minute. All right, everybody. Thanks for sticking around. We are going to read through the next couple of installments of Captain Britain. Today, we get to cover Captain Britain numbers 3 and 4. Issue 3 is called Mayhem on a Monday Morning. We've got Chris Claremont as the writer, of course, Herb Trimpe on pencils, Fred Keita on inks, George Russo's on colors, Irv Watanabe on letters, and Larry Lieber, Stan's brother, is the editor. This book was published in October 1976. I'm Chad Anderson, and I will be playing your narrator.
I'm James Lee Campbell, and I'll be Captain Britain.
I'm Giza Gobo. I'll be playing Di Thomas, Women, Dora, and Sandy York.
Hi, my name is Robin Moffat. I'll be Charlie, Bug Number One, and the indomitable Courtney Ross.
I am Ben Hume, and I'll be playing Jack O'Tanner, Bug Two, and Royce.
And I'm Christian Smith, and I'll be playing the manager and Hurricane.
Hurricane is something. We'll get there. On the cover of this book, and as a reminder, these little Captain Britain books would only be about 8-page stories. Usually one page is not colored, which is very odd. There's a little Captain Britain fun page somewhere, and then the other parts of the book are all reprints. So these two stories we're going to do are each just 8 pages. On the cover of Captain Britain number 3, we see Captain Britain gripping his battle staff in both hands. He jumps off a roof at a group of armed and armored bank robbers, all dressed in green and gold and firing laser pistols. Several of the robbers are knocked unconscious in the broken window behind him. Armed cops are hiding behind a cop car. And as two men are firing at Captain Britain, they yell,
"The place is teeming with coppers."
It's not the coppers that worry me. It's Captain Britain.
The story? Mayhem on a Monday morning. There had been no warning. One moment, it was an average Monday morning at the Chambers Saint Bank, also labeled Barclays Bank. The main floor crowded with the usual mixture of Thames University students and dockyard laborers. And the next instant, all hell breaks loose. We see an image of Captain Britain on the horizon as armed bank robbers storm a bank where Brian Braddock just happened to be. He's dressed in a white button-down shirt, brown jacket, and brown pants. The civilians in the bank are panicking.
Those men, they're smashing through here like something out of Kojak. Captain Britain could stop this. So long as I'm in my Brian Braddock identity, I'm helpless.
My God, it's a robbery!
Spread out, mates. Take everyone here hostage. And if anyone gives any trouble, let them have it.
But I must try to stop them. I must. I'll go for the leader and hope he's not ready to face a murder charge.
What, they're trying to play the hero, eh, kid? Well, that's fine by me. It's your skull that's gonna get cracked.
Brian Braddock rushes at the leader, only to get a gun butt to the head. The bank manager is concerned.
Ugh. If anyone else steps out of line, they'll get a bullet instead of a rifle butt. Do I make myself clear?
You callous. If you've killed this lad...
I haven't, Mr. Manager. I know my trade better than that. Now, everyone except the manager, get up to the front of the bank. You're all our insurance, because if anyone starts shooting, you lot will be the first to go. Come with me, mister. Downstairs to the main security vault and the £1 million in gold stored down there.
There are cop cars coming. Somebody must have tripped a silent alarm.
Blast! There was supposed to be a diversion to keep the police occupied. What's gone wrong?
Oh, nothing really. The diversion went off as planned, drawing the attention of nearly all of the Southwark division. Unfortunately, the assault groups hadn't reckoned with a CID, or Criminal Investigation Division, flying squad, on roaming commission out of Scotland Yard. Pure bad luck. No more, no less. But that's the way it goes sometimes. One of the thugs fires a gun, fizzack, blowing up a car as the coppers rush for cover.
About all you men, get to cover! At the double!
It don't matter any, though. We may have planned this job to go down peacefully, but we're more than willing to make a fight of it if we have to.
Inside, Brian Braddock is waking up.
Remind me never to do anything that silly again. Oh, my head. Wait, my plan. It worked. The robbers have crowded everyone to the front of the bank, leaving me alone back here in the shadows, where I'm free to change to Captain Britain with no one being the wiser. Funny, all it takes is a touch of my amulet and a mental image of the Ring of Darkmoor Stones, and presto, enter the UK's one and only superhero, Captain Britain. If only I was sure I wanted the job.
Now in full costume, Captain Britain launches at the closest thug, hitting him in the head. Swock!
And yet, I can't stand idly by while innocent people's lives are threatened, not while I've the power to help them. So help them I shall, beginning right now.
Images, fast and furious, hammering at the minds and senses of the people caught in the sudden vicious firefight. In the bank, tellers and patrons huddled on the floor, some screaming, some sobbing, as bullets zip overhead. Pow, pow, burp, pow, all praying for this nightmare to end. On the street, a BBC film crew trying to get some footage, trying to stay out of the way, trying to stay simply alive. And finally, the police, helplessly outgunned, the pistols of the few special branch officers authorized to use firearms, no match for the raiders' automatic weapons. Meanwhile, Captain Britain leaps to the upper floor and dislodges his battle stave.
From the sound of things, the police are having a rough time, but maybe I can even the odds a bit. With all this shooting, it's a miracle no one's yet been hurt, but even miracles can't last forever. I've got to hit the robbers hard and fast, disorganize them before they have a chance to turn their guns on the hostages.
Bert! I mean, number 7, behind us!
That tears it. I've been spotted. I must silence these two before they can sound a warning or start shooting in my direction. After all, I'm not bulletproof. And the only way to stop them is to use my trusty quarterstaff again as a high-powered javelin and hope this trick works as well today as it did when I fought the Reaver.
The hero throws his staff, knocking both men through the window. Skabash! Outside, Chief Inspector Di Thomas is looking in.
Chief Inspector Thomas, look.
I've got eyes, haven't I, Royce? Seems that this is one bank job Vixen's mob isn't going to get away with. Wonder which police unit got inside to stop them.
Sorry, Chief Inspector, but it isn't a police unit at all. Merely a superhero. But in this case, that's enough. He hits two more thugs. Bethack!
These are the last of the hoodlums, I think. Ah!
Wrong, Brian. One has a gun right behind you, and the blast nearly hits you. Fizak!
I don't know who or what you are, Boyle, but you've mucked up one of the Vixen's biggest operations. And Vixen is a lady who don't take kindly to people who get in her way. Which means, hero, in case you ain't figured it out by now, that I've gotta kill you.
Is that so, my friend? Captain Britain eats halfpenny hoods like you for breakfast.
Halfpenny hoods.
Wow.
Quarterstaff to the gut, thou to the wrist, kabat to the head, brock.
That's the spirit, Brian. Lots of verbal bravado to mask the pain in your side from the blaster's near miss. Face it, chums, if you hadn't sensed it coming at the last instant and dodged, but I suppose if one wants to be a superhero, those are the risks one takes. You're finished, friend, but I have a final word before I turn you over to the police. Tell your boss, the vixen, to expect me, because I'll be coming after her next.
The thugs are defeated, and in come the coppers.
I wouldn't count on that if I were you, mate. And if you're wondering who I am, the name's Di Thomas. Chief Inspector, CID, and as far as you're concerned, Captain Britain, I'm one cop who dislikes supervigilantes as much as they dislike supervillains.
That's bloody marvellous. I thought I was one of the good guys, but obviously he doesn't.
Thus, a fateful meeting of foes is postponed by a skeptical minion of the law. It's a long day, hours spent at the crime scene, more hours of interrogation in Di Thomas's office at Scotland Yard, until at the end, Cap isn't sure precisely who is under investigation, the criminals or the superhero. Finally, though, they let him go, and after a quick back-alley change, Brian Braddock makes his way across the river to the grounds of Thames University, deciding on impulse to stop at the school's official pub, the Flying Finish. Dora, the bartender, greets him as he walks in to the dingy pub, where model planes hang from the ceiling. Brian wears a button-up shirt, blue jacket, black pants.
Hello, Bra-love. Haven't seen you around here in donkey's years.
Hello, Dora. How's business?
Can't complain. Oh, Courtney Ross was asking for you. Nice girl, Courtney. You should take her out sometime, Brian.
Oh, come off it, Dora. Courtney can have her pick of any man in school. What would she want with me?
Why not ask her, Brian? She's only a few tables away. Courtney nearby has a thick head of brunette hair and hoop earrings. She's feeling frustrated at the brash Jack O'Tanner, chugging a beer as he flirts with her. He's got curly brown hair and orange turtleneck and a green button-up shirt. On her other side is Sandy York, full shirt, tie, and jacket, wearing thick glasses, his light blonde hair in a mod boy cut.
Brian Braddock is a spineless wimp, and that's all there is to it.
Jack O'Tanner, you make one more crack about Brian, and I'm going to forget I'm a lady. Now, we're all going to the flick.
He's a don't laugh.
I love it so much.
You said you were a lady, and I was like, I know you.
Composure. Oh, fuck. Right. We're good.
Here come the giggles.
Don't. It's not going to happen. Now, we're all going to the flicks, right?
Sorry, I have like 800 characters this I don't know, Courtney. I hear the film was a fourth form vocabulary. You sure Jacko will be able to understand it?
You shut up, Sandy York. What I said to Jacko goes for you too. Oh, there's Brian. Hello, Brian.
Hmm? Oh, hello, Courtney.
Look, a bunch of us are going to the cinema. Would you like to come along?
I can't, I'm afraid. I have a lot of work to catch up on.
I see. Maybe next time then.
But there won't be a next time. Not if Jack O'Tanner has anything to say about it. So long, Wimpy.
One of these days, Tanner, you'll push me too far. I'd have loved to have joined you, Courtney. I'm still weak from today's battle.
That's enough of Brian Braddock for this issue. As we turn our attention to Hounslow Way, to a shabby industrial street off of Heathrow, a man in a newsboy cap, turtleneck, and trench coat, and he's selling papes. A rolled up newspaper in his hand with the headline, Captain Britain Strikes Again. Britain's own superhero smashes bank mob.
Hey, pa!
You Israel tramp, now push off!
Fool, you insult me at your peril, but what's this? If this story is true, perhaps I won't have to travel to America after all.
The man moves faster now, his gait that of someone half his age, as he enters the long, deserted warehouse and reveals there's more afoot here than meets the eye. This frightening-looking man rips his stage makeup and coat off, revealing a very fit body underneath. Meet Albert Potter.
Ah, it's good to be free of this foul disguise. But mark my words, the day is coming when I will no longer have to skulk about in the shadowed streets like some outcast. And more, those who hunt me now will soon flee from my vengeance and my power. So beware, Captain Britain, for if you are Britain's first superhero, it is only fitting that you be destroyed by her first supervillain, Hurricane.
Just the beginning, to be continued. Right now, we jump to Captain Britain number 4. In Hour of the Hurricane, writer Chris Claremont, Herb Trimpey on pencils, Fred Kaida on inks, Maurice Severin's on colors here, with Irv Watanabe on letters, and Larry Lieber, the editor. On the cover, meet the Hurricane, a bulky supervillain in an all-black costume with yellow striations on the ankles and wrists, a massive apostrophe-looking design on the chest, a yellow electric mark down the center of the mask, the eyes glowing red. He's generating hurricane winds all around him as Captain Britain is caught in the wind, his quarter quarterstaff in hand. Behind him, civilians, cars, and debris are all caught up in the wind. Morning. The autumn sun has not yet risen over the Thames estuary. The sprawling city of London lies still and quiet in pre-dawn darkness. It's a private time, the world poised between sleep and wakefulness, much as a young physicist-turned-superhero hangs poised 15 feet above the floor of Thames University's gymnasium. It's a time for dreaming and soul-searching. Captain Britain has his quarterstaff balanced on a balance beam as he suspends himself in the air high above it.
After a week cooped up in classrooms and physics labs, it's good to get into some action again. Even though my opponents are only a vaulting horse, the old balance beam, and parallel bars, it's strange, almost frightening, the ease with which I've adapted to life as a superhero. As if I've been doing this for years, instead of only a month. Well, time to return to reality. People will soon be up and about, and it wouldn't do for Captain Britain to be seen exercising in a gym reserved by Brian Braddock. Blast, someone's outside the door, and from their sound, they're about to come in. If I wait till I land to switch identities, my secret will be out. I've no choice. I must change midair and hope that Brian, who's far less than a superhero, can survive the landing.
Pulling his amulet off, Brian switches back to his school uniform, the open blue shirt and blue pants over a white shirt, and falls to the ground, thump me, and wearing the same school uniforms, in walks Jacko Tanner and his two flunkies.
Well, what have we here? What goes, Braddock? You figure to be the first in the queue for the 1980 Olympic team? How reckless. A delicate chap like you working out with all this dangerous equipment. Why, you might have been hurt.
Jacko fakes concern with sarcasm and offers to help Brian up.
Take your hands off me, Jacko Tanner.
Goodness, such raw hostility from our mild-mannered resident genius.
I'm warning you, Tanner. Stop taunting me or one of these days I'll...
You'll what? You'll nothing, that's what. You'll merely turn on your heel, walk away. See what I mean? Your problem, Brian, is that you're as predictable as you are gutless.
A coward. That's what they think I am. And a weakling. Just because I won't fight them. But none of them knows what happened to my parents or of the vow I made to them. It was an oat uttering long... It was just a little oat. It was an oath uttered long before the birth of Captain Britain.
As Brian walks away brooding, Courtney Ross rushes after him, wearing a purple business dress with an orange fastener at the neck.
Ryan. Hey, Ryan Braddock.
What? Oh, hello, Courtney.
Hello yourself, chum. Sandy York told me you'd be here. I thought if you hadn't eaten yet, you might like to join me for breakfast.
I'd love to.
The two of them start off across the university grounds, blissfully unaware that this quiet, beautiful November morning has but a few moments more to spare. Nearby, the super powerful hurricane flies through the air and crashes into the school buildings, emitting as much destruction as possible. Ba-fam!
Hear me, people of London, and beware, for I am the voice of doom and destruction. I am Hurricane.
Courtney, look out.
And I am here to destroy Captain Britain. Excellent. My thrusters are propelling me at an incredible speed, and my speed, combined with my invincible body armor, makes me a human battering ram. Now, I'll try my wrist blasters. Ha! They're even better than I hoped. They focus the full force of a full-blown hurricane into a beam, mere inches in diameter, giving me the power to shatter a skyscraper as easily as I destroy this car.
More on Christian's mere inches of diameter and human battering ram later. A wind blast shatters a vehicle. Shabow!
When the beams are reversed, they create a suction of irresistible proportions.
You bitch.
I was so close.
So close.
That's what she said.
Hey, he's had no complaints.
Stop quoting my growler profile at me. It's not fair. And when the beams are reversed, they create a suction of irresistible proportions. Those fools at the Institute, they all ridiculed my theories. They call me a madman. They will mock no more. I am the master of a force that dwarfs the strongest H-bomb, the most powerful, irresistible force known to man or nature, a rampaging hurricane.
More focused winds, kabak. Scram! Entire sections of buildings are disappearing.
Ryan, what's going on? That man, why?
I don't know, Courtney, but his power blasts are ripping the university apart. You stay here. There may be people trapped or injured in the wreckage. I'm going back to help them. I hated to leave Courtney. Even on the periphery of the ground, she is in danger from Hurricane. All of us are. It's only a matter of time before his blast winds start killing people, unless someone stops him first, and it can't be the police. They're no match for Hurricane. So, like it or not, the job falls to...
Brian puts his amulet back on, summoning his costume and quarterstaff.
Captain Britain, I can't touch Hurricane while he's hovering above on his boot jets, which makes this the time to put my morning workout to use and pole vault up to the foe's level. And I...
A kick to the solar plexus in midair. Shock! And Hurricane falls to the ground below. Tham! With Captain Britain right behind him.
Good morning. Lovely weather we're having until you came along.
Captain Britain?
The one and only. I trust I'm what you expected.
All and more, but yet not enough. My body armor absorbed the impact of my fall, leaving me free to attack. How does it feel to be hit by the full fury of a hurricane's winds?
To be brutally honest, my friend, it hurts.
A wind blasts the hero into the wall of the memorial gym. Scow! And the wall breaks behind him. Wham! Jacko and his buddies are still inside.
Jacko, look!
I see him, Charlie. It's that Captain Britain the papers were writing about. What's he doing here?
Trying to save your worth of skin, Jacko. I'm wondering why he bothers. But I better get back to Hurricane fast before... Oh no, here it comes.
Imagine, if you will, a hurricane 10 meters high and 30 meters wide, swirling in the center of the university's grounds with winds in excess of 200 knots and in the center of the vortex, secure and protected by the dead calm of the storm's eye, stands a lone, laughing madman. Facing the raging winds, Brian launches on his quarterstaff directly into the storm, kicking Hurricane right in the face.
Only one way to reach Hurricane, a pole vault, but my jump has to be perfect, because if I miss the storm's eye and get caught in by those winds, it worked.
You? That's impossible. You couldn't?
Wrong. I could and I did.
Ha! I tripped you, Captain. Snared you in my winds. You'll never escape.
He's right. Wind, rain, always strongest right around the eye. Blasted elements hammering at me, smashing me down. I can't take much more of this.
The battle's quickly done, and a hero lies defeated. Captain Britain falls to the ground.
I beat him on my first outing. I destroyed England's only superhero with hardly any effort. I shall destroy all those who dare oppose me. Today, it was Captain Britain. Tomorrow, it will be all mankind.
Dun, dun, dun. To be continued next time in Captain Britain number 5. All right, this is a delightfully silly story about Brian Braddock hooking up with Hurricane. We'll talk about it. But we introduce a lot of characters here that are really important to the Captain Britain stories to follow. So that first couple issues is the setup. He gets his powers, fights that ridiculous supervillain that we met last time. And today now he faces his first very serious supervillain threat. Welcome to this delicious cast of people. Let's talk a little bit about this story and some of the things that stood out to each of you. One of the characters that we meet in this story, who feels like a little character, is Chief Inspector Di Thomas. Now, Di Thomas goes on to have a pretty long life in Excalibur and other books. I think has nearly 70 appearances over the years. Giza, what was it like to play this detective at Scotland Yard? And is Scotland Yard a place you've ever been?
I've never been to Scotland Yard, and I'd like to keep it that way, preferably. I mean, they had all of 2 lines in this. So there wasn't a lot to explore, but now that I know that there's more to come, or they at least explored more, that's going to be fun.
Really fun character. I know you got to play a campy supervillain last time, but today was a smattering of roles. My favorite was your role as Dora, the bartender. That was really fun.
Oh, yes.
There was something just... me and Dora spoke to me spiritually, really. There's something about me and a bartender that just clicks. The humor in the writing has really come out in a lot of the narration parts, but also just little things specifically Captain Britain is saying to himself, I think are hilarious. In his head, he's so sarcastic. It was a hurricane saying, like, all of the power of the hurricane, how does it feel? And then he says, like, well, actually, it hurts. Yeah.
I love that. Yes.
So Dora works in a pub called The Flying Finish. Do any of you have a local pub that has this kind of vibe?
I used to, when I was growing up, I did, yeah.
What was it called?
It was called The Plumber's Arms, and it was one of those pubs where if a stranger walked in, everyone turned. It was awful. It was terrible. Looking back on it, it was awful. But yeah, imagine the Queen Vic, just with really bad countryside accents.
There's like so many, maybe this is just Glaswegians being alcoholics, but there's like every single pub is like this in Glasgow. I grew up next to one that all of my family drank at. I was too young to go. I just remember going past it. It was called Pipe Rack. And everyone who just came out of it, I was like, oh, they don't look like a, they look like a Disney villain. That was my conception of them as a like 5-year-old. I think I was right. So
this bar, the Flying Finish, the only time we ever see it again is in Excalibur number 5, which is many years later. So Claremont did his homework and brought that back in another story. We also meet or get referenced an incredible character called the Vixen in this story. She's not seen yet. Vixen is this just kind of like sexy, sultry gang leader who has some really wild stories. We'll meet her as time goes by. But Robin, what was it like to play Vixen's thug number one?
Oh, getting to be thug number one. Honestly, I would like to thank my mother for all the work that she put in that led me to this place. I feel honored and privileged to be thug number one. Courtney Ross, whatever. Thug number one. That's the BAFTA. Thank you. No, it was actually really fun. Getting to see a little reference to the Vixen was really cool because I read all of Excalibur. It was really fun to see that. I really hope that she shows up as we continue to read on.
Well, she doesn't. Vixen is referenced a whole bunch, but what? She doesn't actually show up until a story called, in a title called Daredevils, number 9, until 1983. It's 7 years before we meet the character. Wow. But she goes on to have quite an extensive history. Well, she shows up like 12 times over the years, but she's kind of unforgettable. We, of course, meet the delightful Courtney Ross. I've done an episode on Courtney out on the show if you want to go give it a listen. Courtney Ross has an alternate double that turns into Opal Luna Saturnine.
Oh, I'm obsessed with Courtney Ross. It's so weird seeing her here where she is just like the generic girlfriend character and she's not really developed as much. When she shows up in Excalibur, she's like a boss of a bank and she is a dom bitch. She is there to step on Brian Braddock's balls, whereas here she's just like, oh, I hope you'll go to the cinema with me. I'm like, babes, you can do so much better than this slab of meat.
Fuck, Mary Kill, Brian Braddock, Jack O'Tanner, and Sandy York.
I hate you, and I'm not answering that question. I guess I'm going to have to fuck Captain Britain because it's the least detestable. I'll marry Sandy York because he's a nerd. He's going to get into like software development. He's going to have money. And Jack O'Tanner, kill because he's going to die in a bar fight anyway, whatever.
I appreciate the intimacy. Thank you.
He shows up about 12 times, mostly in Captain Britain and some later stories. Ben, welcome back. What was it like to play a thug and then a bully?
Well, I cannot relate at all.
Yeah, Jack was kind of your typical, you know, thug, where it's just fun to see Brian so over this guy and Courtney also so over this guy, but they all kind of keep him around at the same time. He's giving Malfoy with like Crab and Goyle kind of following around all the time, if you guys know those references. James, if we consider Brian Braddock's journey, this is very on in his history. We start to see a little bit of reference. He mentions, for example, a promise that he made his parents, but we don't know what that means just yet. We'll get to that story relatively down the line as we continue through this. Parents met a tragic end at the hands of a deadly supercomputer, and his father's insane. We'll get there. We haven't met his twin sister or his brother yet. Well, I mean, 50-year-old spoilers. It's fine.
I say spoilers. However, I'm not overly au fait with Captain Britain. So, and what I'm deciding to do is I'm not going to read ahead. I'm gonna go on the journey with him, discover him as we go, because I'm one of those wanky actors that love a journey. We loved it. I love discovery. I'm like, I'm piecing this character together bit by bit. And then when I read that bit yesterday on the about his parents, I was like this, oh, I could Google. No, don't. Let's wait till we discover it.
Yeah, he, if we consider, you know, he had this first national battle. As we begin here, he's now developed kind of national fame, and the complications of being a superhero are starting to set in. He disrupts a bank robbery, but the police don't trust him. He's obsessed with this secret identity and like balancing it all with his life as a student. Even that moment where he's in the gym and he has the power enhancements, but then when people are walking and he's like, oh, I better shift back, and he has to fall to the floor. It also cracks me up. I just have to put my amulet and think of this ancient mythical site, and then I automatically turn into Captain Britain. There's some fun things. It's a silly story, but when you start to piece this character together, there's a lot of care given to his, I don't know, Peter Parker-like development a little bit.
He's very complex in that sense, isn't he? I relate to, it's like living the dual life. And it's nice to be kind of tapping into him this early, because my exposure to Brian is more in later years, much later comics, where he's really established. So what's been really nice is, like, I'm going through a retrospective of Brian Braddock, and I'm really enjoying seeing that and the Peter Parker-ness of it, as opposed to, oh, I'm Captain Britain, I can do whatever the hell I want. This one, he's literally like, oh, I'm not too sure if I can do this. Oh, wait, I can do this. Oh, I'm really enjoying this. I love it. Yeah, it's really nice to be seeing that element of him and not just the established character that he is later on.
Most modern readers know him from Excalibur or subsequent stuff. I don't think a lot of people have taken time to read the originals. We get a lot of key moments with him here as well. Like, Courtney wants him to hang out, but he's like, I just got hit in the head with a gun a minute ago. So he had this big mystical threat last time. Then it's bank robbers. And then it's this guy tossing hurricane winds around, destroying the university. And he's kind of been over his head, although he gets some kind of baller moves here as well. Did you have a favorite Brian moment?
It was when Hurricane was like, you, but that's impossible. You couldn't. And he's just like, wrong. I could and I did. I love that moment. I really love that. I just saw the picture of the comic as well. And I was like, that's the hero moment. I could and I did. And then he gets knocked on his ass, which is perfect.
It's really fun. And then we, of course, had my friend Christian Smith back reading the delightful part of Albert Potter, the Hurricane. This guy is a kind of a credible threat in large ways, right? He's manipulating science and tech in such a way that he just wants to destroy property. There's an odd thing at the beginning where he's like in makeup and a disguise, and you don't quite know why. He has a laboratory where he's built this suit, and the suit design is really sleek and kind of cool. He reads about a superhero and thinks, I must destroy a whole university to show that I'm better than him. And now I will conquer the world. He's, I don't know, every villain wants to conquer the world. Christian, was this a character you were familiar with before?
No. I sort of had a look afterwards and thought, oh, does he turn into like Whirlwind or something that else that we know? And it's like, oh no, he's unique. And you know, he has his, you know, suction of irresistible proportions. What more do you want?
The only other two characters in Marvel named Hurricane, one of them is a guy from an Old West comic book in Two Gun Kid. What would be the worst real name for a guy named Hurricane? So this guy's name is Albert Potter. This Old West villain that fights the Two Gun Kid, what's his real name? It's the worst.
God, it's going to be like Harry Kane or something.
Literally, that's his name, Harry Kane. Oh, Hurricane.
No.
Brilliant.
Oh my gosh, they're a drag queen as well.
there's also that's an alias of Makari of the Eternals. And then for those X-Men fans, there's a second generation of the Dark Riders where like Life Force and Spine and Deadbolt and Hurricane show up. Hurricane's this like shirtless himbo with glasses and like a mohawk, and he just generates winds. He's ridiculous. So Hurricane's journey in this, Christian, what were your thoughts on this character?
Damn villain. How can you not like it? You know, it's drama, it's changing needs and escalation beyond. Yeah, he's gone from, like, say, you know, hiding and taking a newspaper to I want to destroy the world.
Well, he's like super muscly, and the suit design is actually really cool. It's black and yellow. It's great. This guy shows up a handful of times over the years. He's going to be in our next few reads, and then he comes back in 1979, 83, and then like the 90s, and again in like 2006. So it just kind of sporadic appearances. Okay. But the guy from last time, if you recall, has never shown up again. So this is a little bit more of a recurring captain villain. Were there any fun local sites for you guys? I've never been over the pond to your side of things. We got to see like the BBC and the Thames. There's like Jack reference here. Were there any fun moments for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the highlight being Southwark Place.
Southwark. Yeah. Oh my God. I don't know. Yeah. Did everyone else die at the front? Of Southwark. You said Southwark, and I literally went,
I had just felt myself.
I'm doing my best. I did not say Kalor this time.
Kalor.
Honestly, it was perfect.
It was great. It's exactly what we'd expect.
Yeah. I'm still shocked at happening.
Yes. The thing is, I knew I'd fuck it up. I knew it. I knew it. I was going to say Happeny, Hapeny. Oh, God. What is it? I know. Do you know what? I was going to go full-blown half penny.
My favorite was Doris saying, I haven't seen you in a donkey's years. Like, that was really
funny. I haven't seen you in a donkey's years, Such a good phrase as well.
Yeah, honestly, if she showed up in the Queen Vic next week, I'd be really happy with that.
Yeah.
I was channeling Tracer from Overwatch. That's what I was doing.
Yeah.
All right, darling.
All right, darling.
Hey up, governor.
Hey up, governor.
I just have to share that I am obsessed with the spectrum of villains that we got today. Like, Giza, yeah. You played Di Thomas as, like, the campest Disney villain ever. And then, Christian, you were given, like, the most intense panto villain that would have made me piss my pants as a four-year-old.
Yes.
Obsessed with the spectrum. Obsessed with it. Love this.
Honestly, I now want to go back and read Knights of Pendragon using Giza's voice for Di Thomas, because I think that's going to make it so much more fun.
As you definitely should. Oh, we didn't bring up Sandy York at all either. Sandy York is the Ron Weasley of the bunch.
I love
nerdy,
Sandy
thick
so
glasses.
Much.
It's so cute. He's not used super often, but kind of just one more character that occasionally gets referenced.
The one used, I even forgot I was playing them.
You're like, oh no, Sandy York only shows up two times. Sandy York is here and like next time, and then we never see him again. So this
wow.
The character that we could see referenced in Brian Braddock's life very easily. I had a delightful time with each of you.
You can find me on Instagram, UmeEA.
Instagram is JL_C. You can also find my drag account, which is Miss_Kitty_Flat.
I forgot. I'm so sorry. I tried.
Miss Flaps if you're nasty.
Oh, God, how the hell do I follow that?
Well, with some hurricane force winds, of course.
Well, absolutely. Massive suction powers.
We did not talk about the suction, Chad. We didn't talk about Christian.
Oh,
suction.
Yes. We broke it out during the story just a little bit. But my word, did Christian have some homoerotic dialogue?
Oh, my God. Again.
Wasn't that the case last time?
Yes.
My huge massive rod.
These comics are so queer. This is
with
what I'm loving about
it. Several inches of diameter.
It's Claremont unrestrained under BBC rules.
And you know he loves to be restrained. Sorry, what?
Anyway.
Robin's gone. Bye, Robin. We've lost Robin too much.
So I'm Christian, Chrissy1701 on Instagram and Blue Sky.
So you can check me out on Instagram, but I don't use it as much these days. My personal account is Negasonic Tranny Warhead. My drag account is October_Fist. But if you really want to check me out, come and find me on Blue Sky, Red Breasted Robin. And you will find me ranting about X-Men and all things delightful.
You can find me on Instagram at Giza Gobble and TikTok as well. Nothing really to promote, just if you are ever about in Scotland and you come to one of my shows, say how you know me and I might get you a free vodka. You
mentioned Grey Malkin Lane for a free drink, everyone.
Here yes.
I'm on my way. All right, everybody. Thank you. We'll see you back here next time in a donkey's year or two. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. Adolf Hitler was a sickly child, doted on by his mother, Clara, who had already lost three children and would soon lose another, all to illness in the young years of their childhoods. His father, Alois, was nearly a quarter century older than Clara and had very little patience for children, frequently arguing with his two older kids from his first two wives and with Clara herself. Prone to drink and frequently gone, Alois was verbally and emotionally abusive with Clara and the kids, and he would frequently beat the family dog during times of rage. Adolf grew up hating his father. Alois pressured young Adolf to enter the civil service when he grew up, like Alois himself had, but Adolf found the idea of this boring job enforcing boring rules as repellent, and he kind of internally vowed to himself that he would do the opposite of anything his father expected of him to do. In 1903, when Adolf was just 13, his father died abruptly, leaving his family a government pension. But just 4 years later, Clara, his mother, also died of breast cancer very abruptly. Both were pretty young, and young Adolf was devastated at the age of 17. A lot of history for this guy after that, but we're going to focus a little bit on his family. He had two half-siblings through his father. One was Alois Hitler Jr., who left the house as a young teen. He had an argument with his dad at 14 and basically just went out on his own, and then started getting in trouble with the law and getting arrested. Alois Jr. Ended up in London for a time. He and Hitler had a strained relationship. He got married to one woman, had a child, and then married another one and had a child, and ended up getting arrested for bigamy. There's more to his story, but of these two sons, one of them ended up immigrating to America and joining the American military and fighting the Nazis and surviving. The other one ended up joining the German army and fought on the side of the Nazis and ended up becoming a prisoner of war at the age of 21 in Russia and dying in prison. So just a crazy side story for the Hitler family. Meanwhile, his older half-sister Angela Hitler, Adolf's other half-sibling, and he did have one other sister through his mother. Angela Hitler married and soon had two children, Leo in 1906, and then Geli in 1908, and a third daughter, Elfriede, in 1910. Leo lived into the late 1970s and Elfriede until 1993. And the middle daughter, Geli, Hitler was obsessed with her. She was only 2 years old when her father died at the age of 31. So Angela, Hitler's sister, moved in with Hitler. She was very close to Adolf and became the family housekeeper. Hitler was 19 years older than Geli. And by the time she was a teenager, he was in his 30s, and he basically moved her into an apartment in Germany, his own private apartment, basically under the premise that she could, you know, move away from her family and attend university. That's not really how things go. He grew increasingly more controlling over his half-niece over time, and she didn't end up going to school, didn't really have much of a life. When Hitler found out that she had started a relationship with his chauffeur, Emil Maurice, who was another older man, Hitler ordered Geli to end the relationship and then fired the chauffeur. He then kind of just kept Geli to himself over the next few years. He would watch her closely, not allow her to leave the house, not allow her to have friends, and would always keep someone to watch her when he was gone. He had a room set up for her and basically just kept her there. Occasionally, he would reward her with trips to the opera or let her go to the movies at his side. But as time went on, Geli began to feel more and more like a prisoner. She wanted to date, to take singing lessons, to move to Vienna. It's alleged she started another relationship without Hitler knowing, and when he found out, he went crazy. He had a huge argument with her one day. One version of the story says that he stormed out of the house and went to a meeting, and while he was gone, later got the call that she had shot herself. She'd been shot in the lung and bled out in his apartment. But another theory is that he found out about this other relationship and killed her himself. So it's kind of a tricky thing. She died at the age of 23 in this apartment after being kept there by him. Many historians have assumed that the relationship between Hitler and Geli was sexual, and there's at least one alleged quote from Adolf Hitler that talked about how Geli Raubel was the only girl he ever loved. He kept her room untouched for years, with pictures of her hanging on the wall. Fast forward, Hitler later marries Eva Braun, the woman who committed suicide with him, and she was 23 years younger than him himself. Now, Hitler again had some siblings. There are no surviving descendants of Adolf Hitler's direct family line up to this point in history, which is crazy because several of them lived many years, but there's no known descendants. Many people assumed Hitler had other children, but that has never officially been legitimized. Now we're going to jump to Captain America 298 Part 2. This is 1994. If you were with us last episode, we talked all about the Red Skull's recounting of his own early origins. But now we're going to continue where he finally shares the origins of his daughter, who's been running around in a nun costume as Mother Superior with her Sisters of Sin, fighting Captain America and Baron Zemo and Arnie Roth. Here's the Red Skull's quotes about his daughter. "I come now to the secret that I have never shared with anyone, the secret I now give up to you. It began on the Isle of Exiles, where I passed those early days after my revival. I sat brooding in my study when I was suddenly interrupted by what at first I took to be a ghost. Amusing, no, but I swear to you that as I looked up, I saw my mother standing before me. But of course it was not Martha, only the nameless washerwoman my fellow exiles had employed to look after them and see to their needs. I studied her face, so filled with awe, and a lightning flash of intuition illuminated my consciousness." Now, if you'll recall, earlier in the issue, he told us how he once met a woman who reminded him of his mother, and he beat her to death with a shovel. So, anyway, just keep that in mind. "I knew without question that this simple, unquestioning peasant would be the one to bear my heir, my heir. Why hadn't I seen it before? Just as Hitler had taught me, I would teach my son. When the time came for me to cast aside the flesh, there would be another as wise as I in evil's ways to carry on the line, so I claimed the woman as my own. So I waited for my seed to take root and grow." Woof.
On the night of my child's birth, I sat, as my brutish father had before me, alone with my tempest and my sullen thoughts. When at last the doctor called me in, it was to tell me that my wife had died in childbirth, and that an infant she left me with was not the son I so desired, but a daughter. A daughter! How the dark gods must have laughed at their jest. Furious, I spat upon the washerwoman's corpse, cursing her for this great betrayal. Then I turned, ripping the child from the doctor's arms, and strode out into the storm. Let the sea devour you, I bellowed, raising the baby up, ready to dash it against the rocks below. But something stayed my hand. I spared her, Captain, and to this day I cannot say why. Thus life began for the woman you now know as Mother Superior. We learn later, by the way, he named her Cynthia, S-I-N-T-H-E-A, so her name is Sin for short. All children should have a home, no? And I built one befitting a daughter of the Red Skull. Skull House was her universe, her only contact with the world beyond. My hands shaped her being, stripped her of weakness, filled her with hatred. My daughter's education was unlike any on Earth. All the sophisticated machinery at my command was brought to bear in the battle against ignorance. With my deus machina, I expanded the girl's consciousness, feeding her the dark visions that had nurtured me in my youth. But youth itself became a stumbling block. I found it impossible to relate to a child, to break through the walls of innocence and naivety. Then I found the perfect solution. I genetically accelerated my daughter's aging process, hurling her headlong into adulthood. Yes, Captain, you heard me correctly. The grown woman you have been battling is barely in her teens. But I am not without a heart. I knew my child had needs that I could not satisfy, and so I took in four orphans, street urchins, much like I had once been, to serve first as her companions and ultimately as her disciples. And he dresses these four girls in, like, Bavarian clothes with, like, Bavarian hairstyles. It's ridiculous. In Mother Superior's church, I preached to them, taught them to revere my daughter, to look upon her as a goddess. My little nuns learned well. They were rewarded with the same premature adulthood I had bestowed upon my daughter, although I could not resist experimenting upon them along the way. A man must have his little amusements, no? And Mother Superior must have her sisters of sin. My daughter was an agile student, Captain, with an agile mind and a black heart. Yet for all her wisdom and skill, she was still a woman, and I realized at last that no mere woman could ever hope to take my place. Perhaps I could have solved this little problem with time, but as I discovered one fateful morning, time was running out. I learned that the effects of the gas that kept me alive all those years was not permanent. The decades had suddenly caught up with me. I was growing older by the day. I was dying. And much as I raged against my fate, there was precious little I could do to deter it. My need for a proper successor became an obsession then. So I looked out upon the world and found Baron Helmut Zemo. He possessed many of my moronic father's weaknesses, but I hoped that, with my daughter to teach him, he might be raised above such flaws. But he too proved a disappointment, as inept a bungler as his father. Still, it amused me to toy with him, to play these two young dogs tear at each other's throats. Each one had believed himself the true heir to the Red Skull's throne, but neither will ever take my place. When I die, I take my evil with me, and I take one more thing, Captain. I take you. We will meet death together, old friend. We shall pass the boundaries of life with our souls entwined, and grapple for all eternity. Oh, it's very horny, this end of this speech. Let me welcome my favorite person, Harem Scarum, to the show to talk about this crazy story. Hi, Harem. Are you a Red Skull fan?
No, not at all. But goddamn, this story was something else.
Isn't it fucking good? It's crazy. J.M. DeMatteis is brilliant.
It's so good. And then you see all the parallel and a foil to his father in the way that he has decided to raise his daughter. And it's really fucked up, if I'm going to be honest.
Yeah. He hates his father. He idolizes his mother, but he beats women to death who remind him of his mother or rapes them. And then, like, hates women in particular. Okay. So let's break this apart. First of all, what was it like for you to read this story? Because it's crazy good, but also wow.
It was interesting, to say the least, because again, you get to see his origins, how he justifies everything that he's done in his life, how he justifies the way that he has decided to raise his daughter, how he justifies his hatred in every sense of the word, and then pushes that hatred onto a daughter that he doesn't see as, what's the word, enough to be his heir, for the sheer fact of her being a woman in this world. And hearing you go into the explanation in regards to Geli, Hitler's niece.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that a fucked up story that we've never
heard? It's really fucked
up. Crazy.
Right. And it really parallels what's going on here in this story. Like, he's... Oh God, I'm so sorry.
Red Skull...
Like Red Skull says that he is very much a product of the teachings that he got from Hitler, but also far above it from what I could glean from the text as reading this.
Yes, yeah.
But then you see so much of his influences in this man, in the way that he decided to, again, raise his daughter, and the way that he decided to sequester her away from the world and teach her these violent teachings, but also obviously didn't see her as on par with him again.
Yeah, truly uncomfortable. So when we look at the origins of Sin, now Sin is a character that comes back later. At the end of this story, Red Skull just has a heart attack and keels over and dies, which is brilliant. It's the best way to die. And then in the next issue, Sin and our Mother Superior and the Sisters of Sin get de-aged back to children. So it's kind of a happy ending. Later writers, of course, bring both the Red Skull back and bring Cynthia back as a grown-up. She becomes like a Crossbones girlfriend, and then she gets her face like burned and it turns into a Red Skull. And she's got a pretty long history in the comics itself. But at this point, we have this kind of male obsession with like the teenage girl. Like, I'm going to make her a woman forcefully. And then I'm going to bring in some orphans. Like, I understand my daughter has needs, so I brought her some friends and gave them German haircuts.
And then he has apparent needs for his amusements with them. I do not want to imagine what he was doing to these girls.
And I want to keep them innocent, so I will dress them as nuns and call them Sister Agony, Sister Death, Sister Dream, and Sister Pleasure. Which one are you, Harem?
You know, I want to be Sister Dream. That's going to be me.
This is a real fact as well. They later change their names in another story when they're aged back up. And Sister Pleasure changes her name to Raunch. Just the word raunch. Sister Death becomes Torso. Sister Agony becomes Slash. And Sister Dream becomes Hoodwink. But the name
Raunch alone. Did they pick these names for themselves?
I'm planning a Sisters of Sin episode on my show, on the Patreon. We'll talk about it more.
Yes, please. Oh my God.
So these origins, there's a lot to do with the Red Skull's disgust in having a daughter. Like, he raises her up to be a tool in his arsenal and then wants Zemo's kid instead as his like natural Aryan heir, because his daughter, not only is it a girl, but she's a redhead. God damn it.
And then he doesn't see Zemo as any better than his daughter because of the line that he's coming from, because his father he already seen as a weakling as is. But he thought that, you know, if he used his daughter to teach him, maybe he would raise above that.
Yeah, so we're planning, and I said in November, we're going to do the trial of Helmet Zemo on my show. That's where we're all building toward. He's the Thunderbolts guy, like, you know, the child of the Nazi war criminals who becomes a Nazi war criminal. It's going to be a whole conversation.
I'm excited for that.
Sin and the Sisters of Sin are just some of those like delicious Marvel weird characters that just come out of fucking nowhere. It's insane. Also, the Red Skull's so horny for Captain America, right?
Yeah, like, my God. And we want to die together with
battle.
Yeah, exactly.
We can grapple for eternity.
And then Captain America just sitting here in abject silence the entire time. And is like, I want to know what he's thinking, but I pretty much already know what he's thinking just by the different panels that we give of just singular shots of Captain America's face.
Well, the other lead-in, if you read the lead-ins to this story as well, the Red Skull is furious at Captain America for having like a gay friend and a black friend and a Jewish friend. And he kidnaps Captain America's gay friend, Arnie Roth, who's a Jewish character. And he has built an entire replica of a 1930s gay club in his basement, and he paints Arnie Roth in makeup, and like this is just in his house. It's just
there.
it's so weird, the whole thing. Wow. What was it like for you hearing this kind of real world comparison about Adolf Hitler's family? I went into more detail in the previous episode about the history of his parents. His father is alleged to have been Jewish, first of all. He had an illegitimate...
I've heard, yeah.
So there's a lot of crazy history, but what was it like for you to hear about Hitler's siblings, and especially Gelly? It's a rough story.
It's definitely a rough, if not interesting in regards to historical context of it all, just because you're seeing into a window of this absolute monster, and again seeing how much of a monster that he was, if that makes sense, even to those who were more closely in his life.
Yeah. And then we draw the 2025 comparison, and there are some bizarre things about evil men in power who are obsessed with teenage girls and having full control over them, from so many celebrities to politicians, from I don't know. We could just give a long fucking list of people, but Donald Trump is right at the top of it, and it's gross. All the comments he has about how, if this wasn't my daughter, I could fuck her, and walking in on teen girls at the Miss America pageant, and dot, 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 and on, and grab him by the fucking pussy. I hate this man so much, and he's just...
Honestly.
I hate it.
Because it's all a vie for power at the end of the day. They see women as supposed to be subordinate, so then women these days, of course, they're not really subordinate at this point. Like, when it comes down to it, women still are kind of second-class citizens in society, unfortunately, because of how patriarchal our society is, but women have a little bit more power these days. Teen girls do not. And I think this kind of puts a lens on that, if that makes sense.
I grew up in the Mormon church, where the original leaders of the church were obsessed with cornering teenage girls. They would have little lotteries, like, I get this one, you get that one, I'll take this one.
It's nasty.
And then they'd pull them away from their parents and be like, God commanded me to marry you in this room, and we're gonna fuck right here, or an angel will destroy your family with a sword, but also you can never tell your mom and dad or you'll go to hell. I mean, right? It's like, it's this crazy, like, kept girl story over and over in history. I hate it so much. That Gelly Hitler, wherever you are, that's a crazy name, first of all. Actually, her name was Gelly Raubel.
Gelly Raubel, yeah.
But also, there's an Angela Hitler in this story, which is somehow so weird to me. And then the story of his two nephews, like, one on the American side and one on the Nazi side, that's also
crazy.
That's a weird history.
I'm very surprised, because, like, I've read some things where it's like, most, I don't know if this is true entirely. Again, these are like different accounts from people, historical accounts from people, in regards to what happened to a lot of people who were related to most of the political leaders of the Nazi party, that a lot of them were either hunted down and killed at some point, or given basically any sort of given the punishment that should have went to the specific leader who did these things.
Yeah, there are some accounts of that, but there's many accounts of people getting away with it too.
So I was like, I was always interested in the fact of what if Hitler had any family, what happened to them after the fact. And
yeah, there's
hearing some of this.
There's a few stories of him having, like, illegitimate children. I may talk about that on other
shows. Yeah.
But it's interesting for me, though, doing this research. Like, I'm doing one Red Skull story at a time, and then I've got to find an allegory from real history. And the more I learn, the more I'm like, oh my God, we're living it all again. It's
we are.
Crazy. It's really...
Unfortunately, this is because time, it's a circle, but it's also because we're not being... I don't think we're getting the right type of education in regards to why these historical events have happened, why these things happen in this manner, what led up to that. We get, like, a broad kind of detailing of the events, but we don't get the, hey, this is the propaganda that led to this. These are the actions of these different governments that led to this. This is how this ended up happening, and this is how the citizens were just kind of told to shut up about it, or how they were convinced that, oh no, this is a fine thing to happen. And we're seeing it again in real time in multiple different scenarios that are going on around the world, in multiple different wars and genocides that are happening right now in the world.
And the information is all right there if you look for it.
It's all right there. And some people would rather shut their eyes to it than actually take a full look at what's happening. And it's like, okay, so this is exactly how that happens. This is exactly how things like this repeat themselves. Because you hear a lot of people say, oh, I would never sit on the sidelines and let this happen if I were in that time period. This is actually the time now to kind of put your money where your mouth is, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The best part of this whole story is Mother Superior's cunty little nun costume. It's my favorite.
Honestly.
you being non-binary, I won't assign you a sister character, but I'm a little disappointed that you wanted to be Hoodwink instead of Raunch. That's my biggest disappointment from this episode.
I don't think I could pull off Raunch.
Do you have any final thoughts on Captain America 298? JM DeMatteis, this is a banger of a story. If you're going to work with this horrible fucking character, this is a crazy story to tell. You know, one thing we didn't really, I mean, we didn't create a lot of room for it, but he's on the Island of Exiles with, like, the washerwoman who is employing the elderly Nazis who escaped justice. And, like, there's, like, this, she's there to attend to her dot, dot, dot needs. And then I must have her. And it's very clearly implied that he raped this quote unquote simple woman that reminds reminded him of his mother. I allowed my seed to grow. Like, just, ew, there's the whole story is just distasteful. After he's really so proud of beating Esther to death in his youth with a shovel. I mean, again, brilliant storytelling, De Matteis. It's great, but it was just, oof, this is the worst character ever created. He's just the worst.
I'm definitely seeing a lot of Oedipus complex with him as well, which is very telling in many ways. But yeah, this was a very good story for such a terrible character in regards to how
he also remembers having been in his mother's womb. Like, yeah, there's
what's going on with that? You know, if I had a nickel for every character that for some reason remembers pre-birth being in the womb, I'd have 2 nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it keeps happening.
Oh, well, and I have to say it this way, sorry, but he remembers being inside his mother, and that's uncomfortable.
Very.
I love laughing with you, my friend. We can take these crazy serious topics and just have a good time. Thank you for hanging out with me today.
What yeah. I've learned from you today, honestly, again, very interesting in the historical sense, and it's
every story I learned is like another arrow in my arsenal. Weirdly, it's like super empowering to learn this truly awful history, these sad stories, you know. And there's going to come a time when it's going to be 80 years past now and people are up on whatever the equivalent of Wikipedia is about how we fought back and what we did, you know.
I'm just saying, I'm hopefully they'll be able to take those stories and understand that you have to step in and intervene at a sooner point than unfortunately what we continuously do.
Yeah, I'm grateful for you. I've been listening to your voice all day as I edit the Colossus trial, and we get to do Big Bertha in a few weeks. So hooray!
Yeah, let's go!
All right, everybody, thanks for listening. We'll see you back here with another anecdote next time, where we're finally going to wrap up this 1984 Red Skull story that does result in his death before they bring him back as a hot clone of Captain America a few years later. So we'll get there. All right.
Oh my God.
Okay, we'll see you back here next time.
Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.